Miss Pickup flew out into the North Sea to pick up a Mustang pilot who'd gone down into the drink. It landed on the North Sea, but then had an engine failure. And the hapless Mustang pilot drifted off into captivity. And the Catalina was stuck on the North Sea for, well, overnight. And come daybreak, they still couldn't start the engine, so they were stuck on the water. And it got shot up by a Luftwaffe Messerschmitt 262.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 9 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. Great to have you all back on board, folks, for another episode of the world's most popular float plane and flying boat podcast. I'm sure you're all still recovering from the incredible stories Michael Steers shared with us last episode, all about flying mallards in the Virgin Islands. I know I am, that's for sure. Now, if you want to get in touch, you can contact me via email on thatmallardguy@hotmail.com or on my Instagram at thatmallardguy. Also, if you love the show and want to hear more stories from floatplane and flying boat pilots around the world, give me a 5-star review on the platform you're listening on. If this happens to be Apple Podcasts, you can write a review also. Now, this week's podcast written review shout-out comes from aviation_enthusiast, who says, "Loving hearing all about the unique seaplane industry. Great guests with interesting stories. Looking forward to hearing more stories soon." Thanks for the great review, aviation_enthusiast. Now, before we jump into our main event, we have a popular segment waiting patiently, ready to make its mark on the show. That's right, folks. The Seaplane Spotlight is back, shining the light on seaplane operators anywhere around the world. Whose turn is it next? Let's find out. Today we have a very special seaplane company. Just like us here at Paspaley Aviation, I believe they are the only other non-aerial work or flight training operator in the world of a passenger-carrying twin-engine flying boat. Now, if anyone else knows of any other company doing so, please prove me wrong and get in touch. Now, this company is Wilderness Seaplanes. You can check them out on Instagram at wilderness_seaplanes or on their website as well. Just Google Wilderness Seaplanes. Now, they are based at a place called Port Hardy on the west coast of Canada, at the north end of Vancouver Island. They operate 3 Grumman Goose, which look spectacular, I must add, 2 Beavers, 1 Amphib and 1 Straight Float, and also a Cessna 185 on floats. They specialise in aquaculture, which I had to Google. It is the rearing of aquatic animals or the cultivation of aquatic plants for food. Very interesting. They also specialise in forestry and they run scheduled services up and down the West Coast. They currently have 5 pilots and from the best of my knowledge, the Goose are single pilot aircraft, which is very cool. Now, in regard to hiring, they do not have any set required hours for pilots to join their team and no external seaplane or flight training is provided. A couple of other cool facts I dug up on their website. They were once the seaplane division of Pacific Coastal Airlines, which has a long and respected history providing air service on the west coast of Canada. But in May 2016, they separated to become their own entity. A few facts about the Grumman Goose is that they first flew back in 1937. Only 345 Gooses were built. They carry 9 passengers and the engines are the famous Pratt & Whitney Wasp Jr. 450 horsepower radial engines, also found on the de Havilland Beaver. This is a cool fact. The wingspan also changes in length depending on whether the wing floats are up or down. Makes sense, I guess, but not something we think about often in today's aviation. So there you have it, folks. The Seaplane Spotlight shines again, and what an awesome company to check out. And for your information, I've already contacted Wilderness Seaplanes to potentially get the chief pilot on board for an interview in the future. So watch this space. If anyone knows him personally, go and tell him to get on the phone and give me a call. That Mallard guy is waiting. I haven't got a reply yet, but I'll hunt him down. Now, to get involved next week on the Seaplane Spotlight, get in contact and I will tell the world all about your seaplane company. Now, let's get back to it, folks. Today, my special guest is David Legg. David is a crew chief on the famous Miss Pickup Catalina flying boat, arguably the world's most famous flying boat. They are based in England, currently flying the airshow circuit all over Europe. David also manages the Catalina Society, which includes a website, bi-yearly newsletter, and Facebook page all about the Catalina. Before we speak to David, a huge coincidence has occurred relating to this podcast. Now today, the 20th of May 2020, on the day of this episode's release, John Cruickshank, VC, from the Royal Air Force in England will celebrate his 100th birthday. Now, who is John Cruickshank? He is the RAF's last living Victoria Cross holder. And if you don't know what the VC is, it's the highest and most prestigious award of the British Honours System. Only 15 medals have been awarded since World War II. Now, John was a Catalina pilot in the Second World War, and David speaks about his story in our interview and why he deserves the Victoria Cross. On behalf of everyone in the flying boat community, John, we would like to wish you a very happy birthday, mate. We hope during these tough times of the COVID-19, you're enjoying your day with at least some of your friends and family. All right, folks, the time has now come. Let's release the mooring rope from the bow cleat. Squat down into the nose bay and close the hatch over our head. And using our yoga skills, we will squeeze back into the cockpit to get going on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Okay, welcome David Legg to On The Step, mate. How are you going?
Yeah, hi Daniel. I'm really good. Thank you very much.
All the way from near Gatwick Airport in the UK, mate. Great to have you on board. First person from the UK. And we're here to talk all things Catalinas today. You're the president, is it, of the Catalina Society?
Yeah, I'm the editor of their magazine, and I do a lot of the admin for it. It's been going for a good number of years now, and I've been pretty obsessed with it all that time.
Pretty easy to be obsessed with one of the probably most famous flying boats in history, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's certainly a famous flying boat. I think it's the most famous, most successful anyway.
Yeah, I definitely think so as well. You said prior, though, that the Mallard's definitely the prettiest, but we'll agree with the Catalina being the most famous anyway.
Yeah, I think it's a good compromise.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if anyone out there hasn't checked out the Catalina Society, you can get on to catalina.org.uk to check out all of David's great work with the Catalina Society. Now, you guys fly pretty famous Catalina as well. I see this on Instagram a fair bit. Miss Pickup, her name is.
That's right. Yeah. So we started in 1984, and we acquired a Super Catalina. So that's a re-engined Catalina with Wright Cyclone engines. We bought one of those in South Africa, and we flew that for a long time in Europe. But it had an accident in '98. So after a bit of a hiatus, we purchased a replacement, and that is the one that you know as Miss Pickup. And we've been flying that on the UK air show circuit since the early 2000s. And it's the original Miss Pickup was quite a famous aeroplane. I can tell you the story of that if you like.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so in the UK during this Second World War, the 8th Air Force had an emergency rescue squadron. And that was equipped with Catalinas. And they were based on the Suffolk coast. So it's on the eastern side of England. And they were used to pick up downed American or English pilots in the North Sea. And one of their aircraft was called Miss Pickup, which is a kind of double entendre, double meaning.
Yeah.
as I'm sure you can appreciate. And so at the end of March 1945, Miss Pickup flew out into the North Sea to pick up a Mustang pilot who'd gone down into the drink. And it landed on the North Sea, but then had an engine failure. And the hapless Mustang pilot drifted off into captivity. And the Catalina was stuck on the North Sea for, well, overnight. And come daybreak, they still couldn't start the engine. So they were stuck on the water. And it got shot up by a Luftwaffe Messerschmitt 262. So pretty unusual, a jet shooting up a Catalina. And it sank. So the poor rescue crew ended up having to be rescued themselves, which they were eventually. But it was a pretty good story, and Suffolk's not that far from our Duxford base in Cambridgeshire. So when we were looking to paint the aeroplane in a new colour scheme, that's the colour scheme we adopted. So,
Right. So that's basically the exact same colour scheme as that original Miss Pickup.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. The artwork is the same because we managed to trace some original Second World War photographs of the original aeroplane. So an artist and photographer copied the artwork for us. It's just in a slightly different position on the aeroplane to the original, but to all intents and purposes, it's a replica.
Yeah, right. I guess for those listening who don't realise the artwork we're talking about here, it's a beautiful lady laying down on the side of the aircraft with the words Miss Pickup next to it. So once you see that, you can't really, you'll pick it out for sure.
Yeah. And when we're floating on the water, she is just resting on the water edge.
Perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
Does she cop a bit of a spray when it gets going on the step?
She does, but she keeps her clothes. She keeps her clothes on. So.
Oh, good girl. What about the history of this aircraft? Can you tell us a little bit about where it began and what flying history it has?
Yes, absolutely, because although it's painted as a United States Army Air Force aircraft, its provenance is that it was with the Royal Canadian Air Force. It was built in Canada in 1943, and it's actually known as a Canzo. The Canadians had a habit of calling their aircraft by different names to the original. Instead of calling theirs Catalinas, they called them Canzos. And so as was built in Quebec, it served with the Royal Canadian Air Force during the Second World War. And after the war, it was converted to a freighter. And it was used for cargo flights and also for photographic survey. So it stayed with the Canadian Air Force until the late 1950s. And then during that time, they removed all the armament, took the bow turret off, the blister turrets at the back. They removed those and generally opened it up. So when it was sold, it didn't need disarming, but it was at that point was converted into a water bomber. So I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with aerial water firefighting.
Absolutely.
And the Catalina really pioneered firefighting using large aircraft. And it had the advantage of being able to pick up water from lakes without landing on a land airfield and being filled up from tanks. So the number of drops you could do in a sortie was much larger using a Catalina. So very successful in that role. And our particular Catalina was used in that role in Canada, in Chile, and in France.
Yeah, wow.
So, yeah, and it carried on in that role until the early 80s. And by that time, using Second World War aircraft for water bombing was really coming to an end. There was more modern equipment around to do the job. So it was pensioned off, and then it was going to be used in Africa for tourist flights in Zimbabwe. But the people who were going to do that, they decided that the political situation in Zimbabwe at that time was not great, and they abandoned the idea. So Catalina ended up being rather unloved on an airfield on Vancouver Island, and that's where it was when we bought it. So about as far away from England as you could possibly be.
Yeah, that's a crazy story. Now, you guys run it now for airshow work, I believe.
We do, yeah.
And so is there water components to that as well? Are you landing it on the water still?
We do. It's an interesting one, really. Our main work, our bread and butter, if you like, is to do airshows. And we do airshows all over Europe. Wherever anyone wants us to go, really, we'll quote for it and we'll go. We don't do that many water shows because, frankly, there aren't that many in Europe. There are a few. So rather like the Mallard, it's an amphibian. So we have the luxury of basing it on land, but putting it on water when we want to, which is a great advantage. So we do a few water shows, but there aren't that many. The vast majority of the shows that we fly are land-based. We do quite a few coastal ones. In recent years, there's been an increase in the number of air shows, particularly in the United Kingdom, where they're held over coastal resorts. So the crowd will be on the seafront, if you like, watching the aircraft display over the water. And the obvious question is, well, why don't we land on the water in front of the crowd. There's a few reasons for that. One is we don't land it on salt water anymore because it's too corrosive.
Yeah.
But there's also practical difficulties. It's if you're going to land in front of a crowd parallel to them, an onshore wind is not great. Also, there's often quite a lot of private boats and pleasure craft moored in the water exactly where we would land. So there are practical reasons why we don't do that. But coastal air shows, they're often in bays. So, you know, you have a sort of semicircular arena, if you like. And it's ideal for a flying boat because you can get down low over the water. You can put the floats down. It looks as if it's in its element. So it works really well. And coastal air shows seem to be on the increase. Not this year, sadly, because of coronavirus. But the last few years, they've definitely been on the increase. And we do a lot of those.
I know there's the HARS Society in Australia. You might have heard of those. They have a cat.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so yep. I believe
the
that
Albion Park.
Yeah, I believe their cat isn't doing any water work anymore, mainly because of insurance, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong, anyone out there. But
I think salt water for them was also an issue.
Yeah.
Because it gets – obviously, they were designed to land on the sea. No issue with that at all. But, of course, when they were designed, they were also built in large numbers and to a certain degree – I wouldn't say they were dispensable, but, you know, corrosion was just an occupational hazard. Well, these days, it's a rare aeroplane, and we want to look after it. And if you put the aeroplane down on salt water, it, as you will know, water gets into the airframe, and salt water is damaging, and it's just very, very expensive to maintain. That said, I'm sure if Steven Spielberg came along with an open checkbook and said, name your price, I'm sure we would do it.
Well, that's it. And salt water, I guess, is it's just something you've got to manage. I mean, in every day we're flying our three mallards into salt water environments.
Sure.
It's just you've got to have a heavy maintenance involved with it. And I guess for you guys, you don't have that ability just to have an open checkbook to maintain these
aircraft.
Exactly,
so. Yeah. I mean, for you guys, I guess it's factored into the operational costs.
Exactly,
with us, we just can't do it. The aeroplane is not – well, I'll tell you a little bit about the ownership of the aeroplane later because it's quite interesting. But, you know, it's not an aeroplane that's owned by people who have lots and lots of money at their disposal and can spend it on that sort of maintenance.
Yeah.
So we steer clear of salt water.
Yeah, and just stepping back there a little bit as well, you talk about, you know, not being a dispensable aircraft. I mean, you only have to look at the Spitfire, for example. You know, over 26,000, I think it was, that were built. And these days, it's so rare to see a Spitfire, whereas, you know, like the Mallard, for example, only 59 ever built. And they're still flying around. So, yeah, I completely agree with the whole, there might have been a lot built back in the day, but right now there's not many left, and you want to make sure that this aircraft's kept in such a good shape.
Absolutely.
Now, with that air show circuit stuff, how many pilots do you have working for you guys, or is it working for you guys, or is it?
No, I'll tell you a bit about how it works. Actually, this all started with when we acquired the second Catalina in the early 2000s. We decided that we would completely change the structure of the organisation. So this particular aeroplane is shareholder operated, so it's owned by 20 shareholders. And most of those shareholders are pilots, not all of them, but probably just over two thirds of them are pilots with varying degrees of experience. And of those pilots, we have roughly six or seven captains. And of those captains, two or three of them are certified to land on water as captain. So the way it operates is that it's basically operated by a group. And they call themselves Catalina Aircraft Limited. And then the operating company, the company that's set up to operate it on their behalf, that's called Plain Sailing Air Displays Limited. And that company basically does all the maintenance, and it manages all the airshow bookings and all the administration. So they're the two separate companies. And then the Catalina Society, which we've talked about a little bit, that's basically a fan club. So it doesn't own the aeroplane, but it's a fan club that people can join, and their subscriptions help in a little way towards the operating costs of the aeroplane. So there's basically three organizations that are involved in the running of it. And we reckon that, give or take, it, to keep the airplane operating, it takes about 50 people. So you have the 20 shareholders who put the money in. We have an engineer. We have a secretary who handles all the administration for us. And then we have a team of volunteers that we call the Cat Pack, who over the winter work on the aeroplane under the supervision of the engineer. And there's probably 20, 30 of those. So it's roughly about 50 people keep the show on the road.
Yeah, wow. And is it set up like a not-for-profit organisation, is it?
Exactly, yeah. The shareholders don't get any dividends.
Yeah. Just the pleasure of flying the Catalina, that's a pretty good dividend.
Well, absolutely right. So the way it works for the, once the pilots are converted onto the type and they have a type rating and, if necessary, a display authorization, then they'll fly air shows throughout Europe and they don't have to pay for that. So the way the air shows work, I don't know how it works in Australia, but in Europe, the way it works is that air show organizers will have a budget and they'll spend that part of that budget on booking aircraft to fly at their air shows. And so that's where we get our income from. So we will quote to fly at air shows. And if the quote's accepted, then we fly the air show and the organization gets paid. And that money goes into the operating pot. So, yeah, it's definitely non-profit.
Yeah, right. Sounds like you got it figured out.
Yeah, so it is figured out and it's a good model, but it's pretty unusual that it's not unique in as much as there are other aircraft that fly on the airshow circuit that are group owned, but I don't think there are any that have as many shareholders as we do. But it works really well and the pilots take it in turns to fly the trips. They basically bid for the trips they want to do. The other great thing about it is that being a big aeroplane, when we fly to and from air shows, we can take volunteer crew members with us or non-pilot shareholders. So people put the work in and put the hours in, but in return, they're able to fly in the aeroplane, whereas, you know, a single engine fighter, that's obviously not going to happen.
Yeah, right. That's pretty cool. How many seats does it have to be able to allow passengers to come in for a run?
So normally, if we fly to an air show in Europe, we'll normally take the two pilots, the crew chief, which is my role. I'm one of four or five crew chiefs, and then we'll take three others. So normally we'll go away with a crew of six. And because of the size of the aeroplane, usually air shows, from their budget, they will pay the expenses for six people, six crew. So we'll get our hotel accommodation paid for. Oh, yeah. We'll get our grub paid for. These things tend to vary in quality. You never quite know what you're going to get.
They wouldn't give you rations, would they? Like the World War II, you know?
No, it's usually a bit better than that. but sometimes it does. You know, there's quite a big reenactment industry in European air shows, so sometimes it is a bit like that. But generally, we're looked after very well. So we can take more than six on the aeroplane, but six is the maximum that we can quote for, because any more than that, airshow organizers are going to look at it and say, hey, hang on a minute, why are all these people coming and why are we paying their costs?
Yeah, fair enough.
But six people, including the pilots, that works well.
Now, speaking of pilots, again, for those Instagram followers, probably a lot of you have heard of a guy called @IndoPilot. His name's Matt Dearden. He's one of the pilots, I think, for Miss Pickup.
Yeah, he's one of our captains.
Yeah, right. Also Flying Mag columnist. I don't know about all the other ones, but he's definitely one I follow on Instagram. You can check him out and see some of the stuff he puts up there of flying the Catalina around. So he's one of the captains there and gets to fly pretty regularly at the air shows, does he?
Yeah, that's correct. So he's pretty experienced with us now. He's been with us a good number of years. He came to us with a huge amount of experience flying, you know, unusual flights in unusual parts of the world. So very adaptable. And he pretty quickly got a captaincy on the Catalina. I've flown with him a good many times. Great guy to go away with. Our pilots, as I said earlier, they come from different backgrounds. When we first started in the 80s, it was very much military fast jet pilots. In fact, the first Catalina we had was owned by two fast jet pilots. And they tended, when they needed other pilots, they either went for older guys who had a lot of experience on flying boats or current military pilots who were very adaptable and could you know, easily convert onto type because their training allowed that sort of flying. So in the old days, if you want to call it that, in the 80s, it was very much military background. When we changed to a share ownership system, that obviously had to change because we were looking for people who had basically had the money to put into the aeroplane. The emphasis kind of changed and it moved towards more airline pilots, one or two helicopter pilots. So there was a shift in experience and background. But that's fine because, you know, we convert people onto the type and they get their type rating. So we can basically start with someone with a PPL and work upwards.
I can imagine that'd be a pretty funny story just doing your PPL navs in the Catalina.
Yeah, well, it's ideally you've got a PPL and, again, ideally you've got a water rating. So in the past, what people have tended to do is if they haven't already trained on float planes, they'll go out to Jack Brown's, is it, out in Florida?
Oh, yeah.
And do a rating out there, you know, fly Piper Cubs or something like that. And then they've got an idea of what it's like to be operating on water.
Yeah, when I took my step from, I was flying a Cessna Caravan amphibian in Vietnam. When I stepped up onto the Mallard, I can tell you right now, that was a huge learning curve, even with the 2,500 hours of water, you know, work that I had at the time.
Yeah.
I can't really imagine that flying the cub on floats in Florida compares much to flying this old bird.
No, but it gives you an insight as to what it's like to have an aeroplane on water.
Yes, probably.
Yeah, so I think it's... Because otherwise, if you go straight onto a Catalina with no experience on water at all, you know, everything is going to be so strange that maybe it's difficult to concentrate on just the flying because there's so much else going on. Whereas at least if you've got some idea of what it's like to be on water, albeit in a small float plane, then you're not coming to it as a seaplane virgin, if you like.
I guess, yes. I don't think there'd be many aircraft around that would actually really give you much of a heads up of what you're going to experience with the Catalina on the water, but you got to start somewhere, I guess, don't you?
Yeah, and we do. Training is great, so we tended to do most of our training down in southwest France at a place called Biscarrosse, which is on the Atlantic coast, south of Bordeaux, and it's an old Air France transatlantic flying boat base, pre-war, and it's a nice big lake. Never have to land in a crosswind. And it's a great place to begin to get used to handling a large flying boat on water. So we go down there most years and the guys who are used to flying it will renew their ratings. And the guys who are new to it, they start from scratch, basically. So general handling. And, you know, they're shown how to do it. But it goes well. I think I've done something like 300 landings at Biscarrosse standing behind the pilots. So it's interesting when you get someone who's never done it before and you think, how's this going to go?
But yeah, I want to get to your role. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, what I was going to say was actually, you know, I've stood behind quite a few pilots who've never landed a Catalina on water before. And admittedly, they're getting fantastic instruction and tuition. But, you know, all of them have made a really good job of it. And obviously then... Yeah, it takes a long time to hone their skills, but, you know, they come to it pretty well, I think.
Have you got any pilots that have had a big flying boat background?
No, to be honest, because, I mean, we don't have anyone who's, for example, flown Canadair water bombers. Back in the day, I mean, in the early days, we had access to a couple of old guys who'd flown flying boats, you know, as part of their flying career. One of the guys had flown a Sandringham, which you'd be familiar with out in Australia and the Pacific. A guy called Keith Sissons, who's no longer with us. So we had access to some guys, but there was another guy who'd flown Sunderlands. But really, it was our chief pilot, a guy called Paul Warren Wilson. He really just, he had some tuition, but basically he taught himself. He soaked up as much experience from other people as he could. And then went out and did it. And I guess he'd probably say, well, you know, he learned by his mistakes, nothing major. But now he's really, really experienced. And we are our own training organization. The Civil Aviation Authority made it a condition that we train our own people. So we're set up to do internal training. But we don't have anyone flying with us currently who has large flying boat experience outside of our own organisation.
Yeah, right. Just a few stats on the Catalina there. What's the max takeoff weight, for example?
Ooh, got me there. It's the actual aeroplane is, I think, 8 tons. So max, I think it's about 12, but okay. Don't quote me on that. Yeah.
I'm just having a look on trusted Wikipedia source here. Some of the stuff they've got on here, max takeoff weight around 16 ton, they reckon.
Okay, yeah.
And then empty weight, yeah, about 9.5 ton. So quite a heavy aircraft, really. I couldn't imagine that you guys would be flying around at max takeoff weight very often.
Absolutely not, no. But that said, I mean, obviously most of the weight is fuel. And we've done some pretty long trips in it, so... you're probably aware, especially if you're looking at Wikipedia there, that it had a range of in excess of 2,000 miles, and it could stay aloft. I mean, typically the RAF Coastal Command used them during the Second World War and would very frequently fly for 17, 18-hour sorties.
That is incredible to think, like, especially with the engines and the noise in that aeroplane. It must have been so... draining, you know, listening
Absolutely.
To that all day long, and then you're up there for 18 hours, and I can't imagine that the crew rest areas are anything like the 777s and 747s that are flying around these days, you know.
No, absolutely not. And I tell you, almost every time I fly in it now, I reflect on that, because, you know, to a certain extent, we're fair weather flyers. We don't have to fly. You know, if the weather's shocking, then, you know, we don't fly. Whereas these guys were flying off of water day and night, very long sorties, very uncomfortable, very boring as well a lot of the time, because, you know, they were looking for U-boats that might not even be there. So you had probably 90% boredom and 10% great excitement would be fairly typical. So whenever I fly, I mentally tip my hat to these guys who had to fly them during the Second World War, because, you know, awesome. You know, it was what they did, really.
I love the on the page there, the crew section. Crew of 10 includes a pilot, co-pilot, a bow turret gunner, flight engineer, radio operator, navigator, radar operator, 2 waist gunners, and a ventral gunner. That's quite the package of crew.
Yes, they tended to fly with a minimum of 8, but would sometimes fly with a second set of pilots if they were going to do a really long sortie. As I say, 18 hours was quite commonplace. But we don't have to do that. But that said, we've done some really long trips. We took a party of school students on an expedition to Greenland.
Wow.
So, and on that occasion, I think we had something like 16 seats, including the pilots. So we can put extra ones in. You just have to pay a bit more insurance, obviously. But on this particular thing, these guys were going to do an outward bound expedition in Greenland, and we were their method of transport. So we picked them up on Loch Lomond in Scotland and flew them. Well, we refueled at a place called Stornoway and then flew them to Northern Iceland, and they camped overnight in Northern Iceland. And then the next day we flew them onto a very remote lake in Greenland, eastern Greenland. And they basically left. They had Zodiac launches, so they got out of the plane. We took them in 2 lots from a land airfield in Greenland out to this lake. And then they went off in 2 lots. And I think they were out there for something like 2.5 weeks. We took the Catalina back to Reykjavik and left it there. And then 2.5 weeks later, a different crew went back, flew the plane from Reykjavik back to Greenland, picked the same number of students up, which is always helpful. and then flew them back to the UK. An amazing experience.
I'm going to have to give my high school a phone call, because that was definitely not one of our school camp options, I can tell you right now.
No.
That sounds like a pretty epic school camp.
Yeah, it was great. It took about 3, it's called Worksop College, which is a college up in on the Nottinghamshire-Derbyshire border, so northeast Midlands. And it took about 3 years to organise, but it went very smoothly. The plane behaved itself impeccably, which is always helpful. But on that occasion, obviously, a lot of weight, because there were 16 people on board plus a shed load of fuel. So on that occasion, we were operating, you know, at a pretty heavy weight.
Yeah, probably not something that the crew would normally be used to.
No, that's right.
And what about the engines, mate? Are they still the same engines that you spoke about
yes.
before?
So we've got the original type of engine. So that's the Pratt & Whitney Twin Wasp R1830. So that's pretty much the same engine type as the DC3 Dakota.
Yep.
So they're 1,200 horsepower, 14 cylinders. The aeroplane that we originally operated, that had been re-engined with Wright Cyclones. So they're still 14 cylinders, but they were 1,700 horsepower instead of 1,200. So extra 500 horses each side. There were a few of those. They were post-war modifications. But the Twin Wasp one that we have now, it runs really sweetly. They're nice engines, very reliable. And good for spares. There are Twin Wasp spare parts sitting on shelves in the States. Very easy to get.
Probably not that expensive an overhaul either.
No, I mean, well, we get our engines overhauled in Idaho, so there's a transportation cost there. But we use an engine shop called Anderson's in Idaho.
Yeah, I've heard.
Who are very experienced on big radial engines. So that's who we trust our engines to. So you have to get the engine there. But, there's always a cost involved, which is why we need to make money on the airshow circuit.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have a spare engine sitting around just in case?
We do. In fact, the spare engine's currently in Idaho.
Okay.
It may even be on its way back at the moment. I don't know. It's one of the problems of coronavirus at the moment is that none of us volunteers can access the site where the aeroplane is based.
Oh, right.
At Duxford. So it may be that the engine is back or on its way, but it's. I know it was nearing the end of its overhaul. So we have two engines on the plane and a working spare.
And what else about the maintenance can you tell us about? Like you said you had one engineer involved there. Is it on just a yearly maintenance schedule? Does it fly enough to have regular maintenance done? How's that all work?
It does, yeah. So it has to have a 50-hour check, oil change, that sort of thing. And we certainly fly more than that every year. This year will probably be an exception, but most years we will fly well in excess of 50 hours. So at some point, a 50-hour check will be done. And then it goes up from there. So we have a maintenance schedule that's approved by the Civil Aviation Authority. You have a very experienced engineer. He was originally an RAF engineer on fast jets. And when he left the Air Force, he joined us. And he was mainly airframes, not engines. But he did all the courses, trained on... Well, he was with us with the Cyclone Catalina and now the Twin Wasp one, so he's experienced on more than day-to-day maintenance, but if we have to strip an engine, then it'll go to an engine shop, but he's able to do most work on the aeroplane. He's done things like design and install new emergency exits, that sort of thing. So very experienced guy, invaluable to us.
Yeah, right, that's great. And what about your role? You spoke a little bit about you being behind the pilots there. What's your role when it actually comes to flying the aeroplane?
So when flying in the aeroplane, I, for want of a better title, I'm called the crew chief, and I'm a volunteer. And we have three or four, maybe five crew chiefs who can do the role, and we share the trips between us. And basically, the aeroplane, when it flies with a minimum crew of three. So pilot, co-pilot, and crew chief. And the reason we have the third man on board is because there are certain procedures, mainly emergency procedures, that if they are required, they can't be handled from the cockpit. So, for example, if the main gear doesn't go down, that's not something that can be sorted out by the pilot or the co-pilot, not unless one of them leaves the cockpit. So we fly with a third man, the crew chief, and the crew chief is trained, as I say, for example, to put the main gear down or the nose gear down if the hydraulics have failed or for some reason it hasn't lowered. Similarly, if we put the floats down and the floats don't go back up again, the crew chief can sort that out because that can't be done from the cockpit. And generally, just there as to assist the pilots in any way they need it. So we fly with a minimum crew of three. And if we do an air display, an air show sequence, then it's also a maximum crew of three, because the norm at air shows in Europe now is that you don't fly with anyone on board who doesn't have a purpose. So no passengers, basically, if you're doing an air show. But the crew chief, my role, that's considered to be an essential role. So I get to fly in air shows as well as the transits, which is great. It's a great privilege.
Absolutely. And are you the only crew chief in the organisation?
No, as I say, there's three or four of us that are trained to do it. We take it in turns. We bid for the trips that we want to go on. And then one of the shareholder pilots does all the divvying up of who goes on what trips. That includes the pilots as well. So so we look after him. We're very good to him. And so in a typical year, I would probably fly 6 or 7 trips around Europe. I'm also a designated water crew chief. So that means that I've got the necessary training to be able to do my role on water as well as land. And I can also do the mooring up procedure if we take the aeroplane up to a buoy when we're on a lake.
Okay, so that's going through the nose there as well?
Absolutely. So, yeah, you basically crawl between the pilot's legs and the rudder pedals underneath the instrument panel out into what used to be the bow turret area. And then there's now, our bow turret isn't there anymore, but there's a circular hatch with four latches, and you unlatch the lid, drop it down, and then out you go. So you choose your moment, and then you clamber out onto the outside of the aeroplane. And on the bow area, on each side of the aeroplane, there's a narrow piece of metal called the mooring platform, which is a bit of a joke, really, because it's only as wide as 1 foot's width. But you perch on that mooring platform, and then with a boat hook, you get the rope that trails back from the buoy. So that's an interesting job. And
We do that as well on the Mallard. Yeah. Our nose is not that big, though, so we can actually stay inside the nose hatch there and pick it up. But I'm just having a look at some photos here now, and it's some things you just don't really notice, you know, until you hear things like that. And I can see those two little strips there.
Yes.
And it looks like there's some bollards on both sides of the nose as well to tie off to?
When we tie up to a buoy, we actually cleat it to the mooring platform itself. There is what's called a stubbing post, which is probably what you're looking at in the picture.
Yeah, I think so.
The function for that was you can't put much weight on it. So it was used for one of the supplementary ropes if you were mooring up using an anchor.
Okay.
But because we don't go on the sea, we tend not to use an anchor. When we're on lakes, we just use a floating buoy. So all the strain, if you like, is taken on the cleating point on the mooring platform. So what happens is that with that role, I mean, you'll be familiar with this, I'm sure, is that the mooring rope from the buoy obviously trails back towards the aeroplane. So you approach upwind, and the rope is trailing towards you, and the captain uses his skill to take the aeroplane to the rope. And I'm basically perched on the mooring platform on the outside of the aeroplane with a boat hook, just waiting for him to take me to the right place. And if he does that, then I just lean out with a boat hook, get the mooring line. And the aeroplane is still under power at that point, idle power. So as soon as the captain sees that I've got the rope in my hand, he will cut the power, so that we don't run on, you know, beyond the buoy too much. And I cleat the rope to the front of the aeroplane, and then we're secure.
Yeah, and there's no reverse on those engines, I imagine.
No, that's right. Absolutely. So, and there's no water. I'm not sure about the Mallard, but certainly on the Catalina, there's no water rudder.
Yeah, no, we don't have a water rudder either.
No, so, and that's typical for a large flying boat. So all your manoeuvring is basically through engine thrust across the air rudder.
Yep.
What we can do, and we do this, is that we can isolate the hydraulics on the three undercarriage legs. So that enables us to put the main gear down once we're on the water and moving slowly. We can put the main gear down and leave the nose wheel up. And that acts as a brake. So you can bring the power up to get air over the rudder to get some maneuverability, but because the gear is in the water, that's acting as a brake, and it's stopping the aeroplane picking up forward speed. Because what you don't want when you come up to a mooring buoy is speed.
Yeah, exactly.
But you do want manoeuvrability.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's a bit of a black art, as I'm sure you know. But we can put the main gear down, as I say, and that acts as a brake.
Basically, every water landing we do, we're putting the gear down afterwards, obviously, not before.
Okay.
For stability and drag for our water transfers that we do. But yeah, that's...
Yeah, so similar.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like, a lot of those techniques are transferable between, even like the Catalina and the smaller flying sure. boats like the Mallard.
Yeah. The original Catalina didn't have that ability. It was a modification that the Royal Canadian Air Force put on some of their aeroplanes, and that's the background to our aeroplanes. So we have that modification on our plane. And in fact, you can just put one gear down and you can use it as a rudder.
Yeah, right.
If you need to.
Yeah, to just put a bit of drag on one side.
Exactly, yeah. So you can shuttle. They all work independently. The undercarriage is hydraulic. The floats are electric. So when you shut off the hydraulics on the co-pilot side below the instrument panel, there are three really agricultural-looking levers and a gate. And you open the gate and then you can operate the three levers independently of each other to shut off whichever gear you want to stay up.
Yeah, interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, perfectly. Yeah, all useful little tactics for little tricks you need on the water, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So I have to say that one of my favourite things to do on the Catalina is getting out on the front there and mooring up. There's nothing like it. It's great fun.
Yeah, I thought doing that in the Mallard and looking back at the two PD6s was cool, but I think looking back at those radials would be pretty epic as well. She idles up to the mooring.
I have to say, I tend not to look backwards too much. I'm really concentrating on what's going on in front of me.
Fair enough. And
you kind of forget the engines are there. And looking at a picture of your Mallard, actually, I would guess that the props on your... Are they PT6s?
Yeah, they are, yeah.
Yeah, the props are probably closer to the bow than our radial engines are.
Yeah, I think they're almost within reach of the mooring line pickup.
Yeah, so, as they're a little bit further back.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, I must ask, have you happened to join the lovely lady on the side of the aeroplane in the water at any stage during this pickup?
No. No. It's an obvious question, but no, I never have. I've dived off the wing, as people do, but no, I've not fallen in. You could. I mean, it's an interesting thing because we don't use a harness, because if you did fall in and then you get dragged along by a harness, that wouldn't be too great. So we wear life jackets, but not the sort that inflate on contact with water, the sort that you have to manually engage. And the reason for that is that when you're in that, you're in quite a vulnerable position on the bow there. And if the pilot decides to take it round in a circle, once you're already on the outside of the plane, at some point you're going to go across your wash.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you can get quite wet. And what you don't want is a life preserver that's going to suddenly inflate on contact with some water.
No, that makes sense. But I imagine that the height above water that you're standing wouldn't be that really high at all, would it?
To be honest, it's not that far above the water, and I'm crouching rather than standing because I need to be outside of the captain's field of view, because he needs to be looking for the rope that he's steering the aeroplane towards. And what he doesn't want is the bowman standing around gesticulating in his line of vision,
taking selfies.
So on that mooring platform, I'm actually crouching down. One foot behind the other, and with one hand holding the open rim of the bow hatch. Obviously, once I get to the point where I'm going to take the rope, then it's hands off. I've got two points of contact at that stage, which are my feet. So potentially you could fall in, but I've never actually felt remotely at risk of falling in.
Now, David, you've done a lot of research on Catalinas over the years and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to hear one of your favourite Catalina stories. Have you got something that really just stands out as, your favourite Catalina story of flying boats back in World War II?
Yeah, I think, it's kind of topical at the moment, in as much as the main protagonist is 100 years old next week. And this is a guy called John Cruikshank, who was an RAF Coastal Command pilot. And he flew with a squadron called 210 Squadron. And he was up in the Shetland Islands, which is right up way north of Scotland, and doing a patrol, an anti-U-boat patrol, out in the North Atlantic. And to cut a long story short, the Catalina contacted a U-boat, and both flying boat and U-boat started firing away at each other. And eventually the U-boat was sunk, but the Catalina was pretty badly affected by gunfire. And John Cruikshank, the pilot, was very badly wounded, and he had to be helped out of his captain's seat, and his co-pilot took over. But when they got back to the Shetlands, John Cruikshank absolutely insisted on going back to the cockpit and carrying out the landing, which he did. And then they deliberately ran the Catalina aground. And when they got into hospital, they found that he had over 70 individual gunshot wounds.
Jesus.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like a calendar, really. But he survived, and he's just, you know, amazing story, really. So he was one of two Catalina pilots that were awarded the Victoria Cross, which you, I'm sure you know, is the highest award for gallantry that anyone in the British forces can earn. And the other one actually was a Canadian Air Force Canso pilot, but his award was posthumous. He died in the action for which he received the award, but John Cruikshank survived. And as I say, he was awarded the Victoria Cross, and he's still alive. He's the only surviving Royal Air Force Victoria Cross holder, and he's 100 years old on the 20th of this month. And a few years back, it kind of gets personal, because a few years back we were doing an air show at a Scottish RAF airfield called Lucas up in Scotland. It's near St Andrews, where the famous golf tournament is held. And John Cruikshank is Scottish, and he was brought along to the airfield by the RAF people to fly in our Catalina. And so we took him for a flight up north of Lucas, up to a place called Dundee. And it was just one of those great moments where you're flying in your own personal favourite aeroplane with this person on board who's just got so much history behind him. And that was a real, you know, it's a real privilege to fly in this sort of aeroplane anyway, but to fly in one with this person who had this personal history, you know, Victoria Cross holder, Catalina pilot, you're flying in our own Catalina, that was a great experience. So that's a kind of, his story is a great story, but, you know, there's that personal story as well, where, you know, I was one of a few guys in the plane who was able to fly with him.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it was great stuff. Really nice guy.
I saw just recently on the news there was a, over in the UK there, I think his name was Tom from memory, Pilot Tom.
Oh, Colonel.
Celebrated.
Yeah, Colonel Tom. Yeah, so he was in the British Army rather than the Air Force, and he's the guy who's just raised millions of pounds for our National Health Service. And on his 100th birthday, he got a Spitfire and Hurricane flypast, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. And is our Catalina man going to get a Catalina flight for his 100th, do you think?
Well, sadly not, because we're not flying at the moment because of coronavirus. But it would have been great. I suspect if it had been a normal year without all this craziness that's going on, I suspect we would have organised some sort of pilot training flight and schlepped up the coast of Scotland and flown over his house. He lives in Aberdeen, which is quite a long way up, actually. It's quite a long way north. But I'm sure that some of our shareholder pilots would have got together and financed. Not to be, because of coronavirus.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame, but it'll all recover soon, I'm sure, and we'll be back in the airs in no time.
I hope so.
It's been awesome talking all about Catalinas with you, David, and really appreciate you coming on. And I know it's a bit late over there in England, very early here in Darwin, that's for sure. But
Well, it's pitch dark here now, actually. We're 10:30 in the evening, so it's pretty dark out now.
Yep. Thanks for coming on, mate. I really appreciate you telling the stories. And
It's an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, like I said, if anyone out there wants to check out the Catalina page, the Catalina Society, catalina.org.uk, and also their Facebook page as well. That's just the Catalina Society.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. So, and we run the society, and for Shamelessly plug the society now, but people can join us for a pretty modest fee, and they get an illustrated magazine twice a year, which I write, and all the subscriptions go towards helping the aeroplane stay in the air. So if there are any Catalina fanatics out there, it's good to be talking to you, and why not come and join us?
I'm sure we can find a few. There's definitely a flying boat and float plane love out there, so I'm sure they'll get on board. All right, David, time has come. Thanks very much, mate, for coming on The Step today.
It's a pleasure. Nice to talk to you, Daniel. Take care.
And that's a wrap for episode 9, folks. I'm sure you loved David's details about the Catalina just as much as I did. Now, don't forget to leave me a review if you liked the podcast, and get in touch to be featured on the Seaplane Spotlight. Or if you just want to talk to me, just get in touch. Love to hear from you. But before we go, here is a little taste of the double-digit episode number 10.
I just happened to hit it at the right time where I wanted to take my career to different parts of the world. I wanted to leave Canada again, and I wanted to stay with Flow Planes. And my goodness, how lucky was I that there was this opportunity in Vietnam.
Very much looking forward to that chat coming to you this weekend. Until next time, everyone, thanks for coming on The Step.